Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
25 years ago, my guest on today's show became an instant movie star when he went toe-to-toe with Robin Williams in one of the funniest movies ever made.
That's all I am to you, isn't it? A meal ticket. Never mind about my feelings. Never mind about my suffering. It's just about your show. Not even our show. Your show. Well, I want a palimony agreement. And I want one now.
Well, I don't have a palimony agreement on me right now. Is tomorrow all right?
Don't use that tone to me.
What tone?
That sarcastic, contemptuous tone that means you know everything because you're a man and I know nothing because I'm a woman.
You're not a woman.
Oh, you bastard.
This is the 100th episode of The Last Lap. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and I could not be more excited to bring you today's interview with the great Nathan Lane. Nathan tells me on today's show that he actually can believe it's been 25 years since he made The Birdcage. But I have to tell you, I really cannot believe that we have put out 100 episodes of this podcast. From our very first episode with Sarah Silverman back at the beginning of 2019, I've wanted The Last Laugh to be a different kind of comedy podcast that's not only funny, but also digs into all of the thorny and controversial issues that have come to really dominate the comedy world. And this talk with Nathan Lane is no exception. We get into all of it, including the time Oprah tried to get him to come out publicly before he was ready, and the very specific reason why a sequel featuring Hank Azaria's Guatemalan character Agador Spartacus will probably never happen. Before we get to that interview, I just want to thank everyone who has been listening from the beginning, as well as anyone who might be checking out this podcast for the first time today. We literally could not have gotten this far without you, and I feel like the show is only going to get better from here, so stay tuned. But now, here's me with Nathan Lane. Hello.
Matt, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Welcome. So just before we get started here, I don't know if you saw the note. Is it possible for you to do a little recording on your end, either with your phone or with... If the answer is no, that's okay.
Yeah. I've only gotten to know about podcasts in the last year or so. And but this is a new thing where they're asking you and Mike Birbiglia, or both asking for me to record the session.
Did you just tape with Mike Birbiglia?
No, he's going after you. He's an old friend.
Yeah, he's great. He's been on this podcast as well. And yeah, I'm a big fan of his. You were the witness at his wedding, is that right?
Yes. My husband and I were, it was like one morning, it was in summer, it was like in July, it was really hot. And Mike called me and said he and Jen were at City Hall, and these friends of theirs, he has this friend, he has this exotic name, you know, my friend Pythagoras and and Ptolemy won't be able to make it. Would you fill in? And so Devlin and I, being gay men, we went, we put on suits, we went down there. And of course, they're in like Hawaiian shirts and t-shirts and shorts and sandals. So there was a lot of people and there was a long line. And I said to Mike, we got on the line with them to, you know, make whatever the application was to get the slot in the chapel. And I said, well, maybe they'll recognize me and we might move this along. And Mike said, Nathan, I don't want any special treatment. And I said, really? Because I live for special treatment. That's really all I want is special treatment. It's why I got into show business. So, of course, we got there and the lady did recognize me and they went quickly into the chapel and we were their witnesses. And then they went off and I said, are you going on a honeymoon? They said, no, we're going to go see a movie and have some pizza.
That sounds about right.
And so when I got married, when Devlin and I got married, we asked them to be our witnesses the hall.
Nice. Very nice. Full circle.
Yes, they repaid the favor.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Has the podcast started?
Oh, yeah. Ages ago it started. Ages ago. I wanted to talk to you today and in this moment because we are just upon the 25th anniversary of The Birdcage. Can you believe it?
Yes, I can.
Does it feel like 25 years?
No. You know, as you get older, it just, it's hard to imagine. You know, I just turned 65, and yet I can't really believe that. And but I certainly believe it's 25 years since we made The Birdcage.
So if I have my math right, that puts you around 40 when you made the film.
Is that right? Okay. Yeah.
Which, you know, is and this was really your breakthrough film performance as a lead, right? It was kind of your first lead performance in this way in a film.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And especially in a film directed by Mike Nichols, written by Elaine May and starring Robin Williams and Gene Hackman.
About as good as it gets.
That's about as good as it gets. And so it's, I mean, obviously it's held up.
I'd love to kind of start at the beginning and sort of where you were in your career at this time when this project came to you. I mean, how did this happen that you ended up being even considered for this film?
At that time, when I was approached, I was doing a Neil Simon play called Laughter on the 23rd Floor on Broadway. I had met Mike Nichols briefly. I'd been introduced to him at a rehearsal hall, you know, and that was like meeting God. and you know, I was very intimidated by him. And so, you know, I just said hello and said what an honor it was to meet him. And, you know, and he was gracious, if indifferent. And then I knew he had seen me in plays. I would hear that he was there, but he had never come backstage before. And I happened to be filming that day the movie version of Jeffrey, the Paul Rudnick play. And so I got to the theater a little late and sort of rushed in. I didn't make my entrance in the play until late in the first act. So I sort of rushed in, got dressed, got ready, and then I was down by the stage manager's desk and I took a little peek to look at the house and I saw Mike Nichols and Diane Sawyer. So I thought, oh, I better have some coffee.
This better be a good one.
This better be a good one. And then very surprisingly, he came back. And, you know, it's like out of a movie itself, him coming back and saying, I'd like to talk to you about a film. And I was like, oh, really? Yes, sure. He said, can we talk tomorrow? I said, yes, of course. So I gave him my number and he called the next day and explained that he and Elaine had always wanted to do this American remake of Le Cage aux Folles, and that he had Robin Williams was going to play one half of the couple. And I said, oh, you want me to play the drag queen? Is that? And he said, yes, yeah. I said, well, that's a very good part. And he said, Robin Williams, Gene Hackman, Elaine May is writing. How does that sound? And I said, that sounds like heaven. So he was very, initially he had cast Steve Martin and Robin, you know, from they had done Waiting for Godot, and they were going to, he was going to pair them again. And then I'm working with Steve currently in this Hulu series.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That he co-created, he and Marty Short. But, you know, if it wasn't for Steve, I wouldn't have done this film.
Because Steve was going to play Armand, and Robin was going to play
Albert.
Your part. Yeah.
Yeah. Correct. So Steve couldn't get out of this other movie situation. And then Robin decided, because of that, Robin decided he had already done Mrs. Doubtfire, didn't want to get an address again. And perhaps it was more interesting for him to play the more reserved half of the couple. And that's when that part opened up. You know, he treated me as if I was a movie star and included me on every part of it. He would let me know what was going on for a minute. It's maybe Robin wasn't going to do it. Mm-hmm. And then he would suggest other people. You know, he said, what do you think of Billy Crystal as your husband? And I said, why, I love Billy.
Okay.
And then one night I ran into him at a benefit and he said, Robert Redford. Robert Redford as your husband. I said, well, if you can make that happen, then you, all my dreams will come true. So finally, it was Robin was going to do it. But then I was supposed to do a revival of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum that Scott Rudin was producing. And it was going to be maybe a conflict with this filming of The Birdcage. And so I had to say no to the movie. I did turn the movie down. The movie, the only movie I've made that people ever talk about.
You almost turned down. Unless you did turn down.
Unless it's a Russian cab driver or a stoner who loves mouse hunts.
Oh, okay.
This is the movie people talk about. So I turned it down, sadly, tragically. And then Mike, I would hear from him from time to time. And when I was still doing the play, he called me once in my dressing room from Ireland, mm-hmm. where he was on a vacation, and said, you know, I'm seeing all these people and I keep thinking you're the guy to play. And I said, I said, you know, you're Mike Nichols. Perhaps if you called Scott Rudin, we could work something out and he might postpone. I said, I have no power here. And he said, yes. And then so he hung up. And then they had a little powwow. And Scott very graciously and kindly postponed the production of Forum so I could do this movie.
I love that. It shows, you know, who had the power, Scott Rudin or Mike Nichols. That's a tough, tough battle.
And ultimately, it worked out for everybody because the movie came out and fortunately was a success. And that was just before we started.
I wonder if Scott knew, had a feeling that that might happen and knew that it would only help him.
I don't know, but it certainly helped in terms of selling the show. That I was this New York actor, and then suddenly I was getting national recognition for this film. So it certainly helped a bit, I would think.
So you said, you know, you were kind of intimidated by Mike Nichols. I mean, what about Robin Williams? What was it like to all of a sudden be the co-lead with him, be a couple in this movie, and really go toe-to-toe with him? And even more so than that, he's sort of playing the straight man, so to speak, for most of the movie. And you're the sort of more outsized comic character. So that must have been kind of intimidating as well.
No, it wasn't. Because of him, because he was, he was a saint. He was a kind, generous, sensitive soul, and was a real actor, as well as being a comic genius at improvisation and stand up. He was a real actor, and he wanted the challenge of playing that role, and he graciously, you know, shared the screen. And certainly he was a movie star who could have said, I don't want to do it with this guy. I want, you know, get me Billy Crystal or get me some famous movie star to play with. And he, no one could have been more supportive or generous than Robin. And we had similar, we were very similar in some ways. You know, we both wanted to please Mike and Elaine. They were heroes to us. And we both had that need to, you know, improvise from time to time. And, you know, he was very protective of Elaine and her adaptation. And in rehearsal, they had said, you know, feel free to improvise during rehearsal and then we'll pick things if we like them. But, you know, when you're really filming, that's when things start to percolate in your mind. And certainly Robin and I, he very generously would say, all right, I will give you a wild take where you can get it all out of your system and say whatever it is that you've been dying to say, or you have an idea you want to pursue. And so, you know, and a few things came out of that. But no, Robin, you know, was, for example, I remember filming a big, it was cut out of the film, but I filmed a big nightclub number, the Sondheim song, Can That Boy Foxtrot, in front of an audience. And Robin had the day off and he came in because he wanted to be there for me, to be supportive. And he sort of stood in the back and, you know, it was, that's the kind of person he was. He so generous and thoughtful and just, you know, he kept the energy alive, you know, doing a piece like that, which is, even though there's real emotions and real characters going on, you know, it's light and frothy, and he kept the energy up and would, he entertained between takes. And, you know, Gene Hackman, I think he had just come off that submarine film with Denzel. Mm-hmm. So this was such a relief to be, you know, he had such a good time. But, you know, Gene Hackman.
I mean, is so funny in the movie, too. And is such a great comedic actor, which he, you know, only did kind of a handful of times. What was it like acting opposite him and dancing with him as well?
Yes. You know, this was sort of Mike's famous no assholes rule. Mm-hmm. You know, he would say to me, I only want, Nathan, I only want nice people, just nice people. Because I think he had come off of this film Wolf with Jack Nicholson, which
had a lot of problems.
Was not a good experience. But Elaine had come in and helped him with the script, had done rewrites. And then I think that sparked finally taking on La Cage aux Folles. But he wanted it to be a happy experience. He wanted it to be a very commercial film, a successful mm-hmm. film, and he wanted it to be a happy experience. And it really was. And everybody not only was a pro, but a really sweet, nice people. I mean, Gene Hackman, I must have said every morning when we were working together, I would tell him he was my favorite actor. And I would say, tell me about Scarecrow, you and Al Pacino. And he would go, Scarecrow. And then so he would tell me, and he was incredibly gracious. And the only time I saw him uncomfortable was when he had to put on that big white dress and the wig.
Yeah. But he's supposed to be uncomfortable in the movie, so it works.
So it all worked. But he was fantastic. And, you know, he's, yes, as you said, as brilliant at comedy as he is at drama. And Diane Wiest, again. Yeah,
fantastic.
You know, Academy Award winner, who's just, you know, adorable. Hank Azaria, who just sort of
incredible
runs away with the whole thing, who's just fantastic and so funny. And that his story is, you know, initially we did a table read where there was an African American actor playing that part, which is how it was done in the original play and film. And then everyone was a little uncomfortable with all of that stuff now. And so they were trying to decide, is this right or not? And Hank, who Mike had said, pick a part you want to play, anything you want to play. And so he was playing the stage manager, but he was using that accent, his Guatemalan accent. Yeah. So everything he said sounded funny. And they realized, oh, maybe, you know, it's South Beach. The maid is Guatemalan. And so Hank sort of got moved up to the role of the maid of Agador Spartacus and then knocked it out of the park.
Absolutely.
Armand, why don't you let me be in the show? Come on, aren't you afraid of my Guatemalan-ness?
Your what?
My Guatemalan-ness, my natural heat. You're afraid I'm too primitive, right? To be on the stage with your little estrogen rockets, right?
Oh, yes, you're right. I'm afraid of your heat.
Then you have young Calista Flockhart and
Christine Baranski.
It's unbelievable.
I'm really interested in hearing about Mike Nichols as a director of comedy and, you know, of farce, really, especially in that the way the movie kind of culminates in this dinner scene, which is such a classic, you know, kind of farcical scene in a play or in a movie. What did you learn working with him as a director of comedy?
Unlike a lot of film directors, he loved rehearsal. And if it was possible, and certainly he did on The Birdcage, it was rehearsed like a play. We would go every day and for like 3 weeks, which is...
That's incredible, yeah.
Unheard of. So it was rehearsed like a play. And then while we rehearsed, you know, Elaine would come in and she would say, like one day, I remember that when Gene Hackman and Diane Wiest arrive and they're talking to Robin and the son about the trip that they took. And I think Mike sort of said, nobody ever answers, you know, when people say, how is your trip? And people go, oh, it's fine. Nice. Thanks. No one really ever answers that question. But what if Gene...
What if he did? Yeah.
...really decided to explain what the trip
is so funny.
Like for him. And then it's so boring that he bores himself and gets it. So Elaine sort of wrote to that. I remember the famous sort of improvisational moment for Robin where he allowed Robin to be Robin for a second, where the dance, you know, the history,
yes.
history of dance
in 20 seconds. Yeah.
So in a rehearsal that came up, And Robin did it. He just did it. And then the day came when we were going to film it. And I wonder with Mike, he was so smart. He was always, you know, he came in and he went out, the smartest guy in the room. So it was a little intimidating. And you know, his wit, which could be, you know, miraculous, but lethal at times. You were afraid, you know, you wouldn't want to get on his bad side. But he was, you know, incredibly kind. But that morning, it was like he woke up and I was supposed to be in full costume for that sequence, for the rehearsal and makeup and, you know, Marlena Dietrich, whatever it was. And he said that morning, it's all wrong. It's all wrong. He threw it all out, and Ann Roth, the brilliant Ann Roth, his costume designer for many, many films and plays, had to scramble and came up with that sort of flash dance rehearsal togs and, you know, the sweat socks and the whole
yeah, it's great.
Bandana, whatever it was. And it had to be reimagined as a more of a looser rehearsal as opposed to we're rehearsing the full with the set and the costumes. So that threw everybody. And then this is what I recall. He was like, suddenly he was waffling on Robin doing that improvisation. That are we taking them out of the story? Is it saying to the audience, oh, look, it's Robin Williams and he's doing that thing. How do we keep it? And then he said, there's no ending to it. And so it was Robin and I and Mike, and we were all standing there and he's saying, I don't know. And what about, you know, and so Robin and I said, oh, this. And I said, you know, a director once said to me, I love what you're doing, but keep it all inside.
Yeah.
and Mike said, that's good. And so that's
yeah, that's a great line.
So we sort of saved this, what seemed to be teetering on extinction, survived. And now, of course, it's, you know, one of people's favorite moments is Robin doing that.
What about me? What do I do? Do I just stand here like an object?
No. You do an eclectic celebration of the dance. You do Fosse, Fosse, Fosse. You do Martha Graham, Martha Graham, Martha Graham. Or Twyla, Twyla, Twyla. Or Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd. Or Madonna, Madonna, Madonna.
But you keep it all inside.
Does that remain a pretty unique experience for you in terms of that level of collaboration of saying, you know, anyone can kind of throw an idea in there, even if it is intimidating?
Yeah, I mean, certainly at that point, we were comfortable with each other and I wasn't tiptoeing. You know, in the beginning, it's just to sit down to dinner with Mike Nichols and Elaine May. I remember bringing my record album and even with Nichols May and asking them to sign it. You know, I couldn't believe I was in their company. So, but by then, we certainly felt free enough to try things or throw in something here or there. When the Schneck and Beck was just a little ad lib, you know. Robin saying to me, "Oh, you're going to the cemetery with your toothbrush," and he said, "How Egyptian!" And little things like that. It was one of those once in a lifetime experiences with, you know, a group of comic geniuses and the best actors at the top of their game. You know, I just felt very lucky to be invited to the party.
Yeah. The other scenes that really stood out to me rewatching it are the ones where Robin's kind of teaching you how to be straight, how to pass as straight. And I was wondering if you had any memories from filming those sequences, because they're so funny.
No, there was a... I remember Mike invited me to his house on Martha's Vineyard, where he showed me for a weekend, where he showed me the film. You know, he and Diane Sawyer had bought this gorgeous estate on Martha's Vineyard that was formerly owned by the stage actress Catherine Cornell. It's called Chip Shop. You know you're wealthy when your estate has a name.
Yes, exactly.
Chip Shop. So I spent a weekend at Chip Shop in the Noel Coward Cottage. And, you know, it was overwhelming. And he showed me the film and I knew that, you know, it was very special. But, you know, for any actor, I think, at least for me, it's always the first time, it's just shocking. And all you can think of is, well, I wish I had done that better. Or why did they use that take? Or, you know, why did they cut that? Mm-hmm. There was one thing before we entered that hotel and played that scene. There was a scene down coming down the street when I've been asked to leave when the parents are going to come for dinner, and we walked down the street, and in a wild, well, I had asked Mike if there's that street there where we were filming where there's no traffic. I mean, once in a while, a car slowly goes by on that street in South Beach. And I said to Mike, I want to go down and lie down in the middle of the street and wait for a car to run me over. And, you know, the fact is that so few cars come on. And Mike was like, well, I think that might be too much. I thought, well, let's try it. But anyway, he let us have a wild take as we were walking to the hotel. And Robin and I improvised. And I got quite hysterical talking to the people in tables along the way that I was going to be homeless and would they take me in? what a horrible turn my life had taken because of him. And then I fainted, but I really fainted. I just dropped to the ground and Robin picked me up and carried me. So by the time we finished, all of the extras applauded. I thought, well, they have to use that tape. Yeah,
that has to go in.
It's so funny. And then Mike said, the first thing he said to me after the screening was, you're wondering why I didn't use that tape. I said, well, it was pretty funny. And he said, well, that was the problem. It was funnier than the scene that followed. Anyway, look, I love the film, obviously. And the scene, that famous scene was supposed to take place inside in a dining room. And then the cinematographer, he's now won 3 Oscars, Emmanuel Lubezki.
Chivo.
He wanted to do it outside because of the back where there's a fountain and a thing. And it was maybe 103 degrees outside.
Oh, yeah. You could tell. It looks hot.
And so that day started. So that was going to be a whole thing. One of the continuity, wonderful continuity lady fainted. It was so hot. And they had hired a young actor. I remember this. That morning, we met this young actor who had, he comes in and says, right away, whatever it is. And he had like 2 lines, maybe.
The waiter or something?
Yeah, the waiter. He was a nice young man, you know, and he was very excited, especially to be working with Mike Nichols and Robin Williams. I don't know if he knew who I was. He was very excited and told us, Robin and myself, you know, how thrilled he was to be working on the film. And that was his first job on a film. So we rehearsed. And then Mike takes us aside, like the children in a divorce, and says, listen, I'm going to fire this guy because it will save a lot of time. He's not going to be able to get it right. And he said, and it's a very long scene, and I can't have him coming in and screwing up the tape. Robin and I were like, oh, Mike, it's his first movie.
Give the kid a break.
Give him a chance. You know, maybe, I'm sure it didn't seem bad. You know, he only had to say right away, sir, yeah. Something like that. And I was like, oh, duh. And then finally, you know, he said, no, you have to trust me on this. I'm going to do it. And so we both hid in our trailers until, you know, the execution was over. And then they got one of the ADs plays the part. You know, I
would do it better, I guess.
I wouldn't say it's a breakthrough. He didn't leave. He didn't leave his job to become an actor, but I guess it made Mike feel better. And yes, I always remember that. How horrible we felt when we started.
All right. Now, this is a dinner party. Let's work with food. All right. Spread some mustard on the toast. Don't use the spoon and don't dribble little dots of mustard.
No?
No. You take your knife and you smear. Men smear.
Smear.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get the goddamn pinky down. All right, make your fingers like iron, all right? Yeah, and stop trembling. Hold the knife boldly in your strength.
I'm gonna pierce the toast.
Yes, other than that, we had fun. I always had fun with Robin. We made each other laugh, and we both loved throwing things in and seeing where it would take us. And so, yes, it's a very fond memory indeed.
Coming up, Nathan opens up about the difficult decisions he had to make in the aftermath of The Birdcage and why he wishes he had been brave enough to come out to Oprah.
Thank you. If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As you may have heard me mention, this is the 100th episode of The Last Laugh, which means there are 99 other great episodes that you can listen to right now. Like our conversations with Sacha Baron Cohen, or Kathy Griffin, or Judd Apatow, or Chelsea Handler, or Martin Short, or so many other hilarious comedians. So please make sure you are subscribed to The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts, so you can hear everything from our free archive and be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts to let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to my interview with Nathan Lane. So you said, you know, Mike was trying to make a big commercial hit, and he did. I mean, this movie was a big hit and probably more successful than anyone expected it to be, you know, especially, you know, because it centers on a gay couple. 25 years ago, that was even more radical than it would be now. And it still would be radical for a movie about a gay couple to do very well at the box office, I think.
Yeah, I think he was determined to have a big commercial success. And I think it is his most successful film, financially anyway.
There's something kind of tragic about the film as well, just in the way that your character, Albert, is treated by his family in a lot of the scenes. And obviously it has a happy ending and everyone kind of comes around. But how do you think about that? Yeah.
One advantage, and it's all, you know, again, it's about casting. The original French film, and it's fantastic. The young man who plays the son, he's very young. He couldn't be more than 17, 18. And he's very beautiful and very, there's such an innocence about him. And it just, you forgive what he's asking them to do. And now in our case, Dan Futterman, who was terrific, but he's much older. He was in his late 20s. He looks like more of an adult who would know better than to treat, you know, his parents this way. So it's a slight difference, but I think it does make a difference. The advantages was having this very young, innocent boy ask his parents to do this so he could be with this wonderful girl he loves. And, you know, it's just a little thing. But I think, people have said to me, well, what was wrong with that son?
Yeah, people get mad at the son.
Why? Yeah, they got very mad at him.
You know, I know this is something that you've talked about a little bit before, but, you know, at the time the film came out and you were promoting and everything, you know, you had not come out publicly in a big, you know, public way. And I'm wondering, did that complicate for you the experience of promoting it and the awards season and all that kind of stuff?
You know, it was something I hadn't really thought about until Robin and I were going to do the Oprah Winfrey show. And I realized, oh, and, you know, and then the junkets, I realized it was going to come up. And, you know, this is what at the same time I got a publicist, the same publicist I have today, Simon Hall, who said, what do you want to do? You know, he too, is a gay man. He's married to Matt Bomer. They have three children. But he, at the time, he said to me, what do you want to do? And I said, to be honest with you, I don't know. I can't tell you that I am out. I'm not in the closet to family and friends, but I have not come out. There's been no need to come out publicly or make a statement. And I said, to tell you the truth, I'm not terribly comfortable walking into a room and going from table to table and discussing my personal life when this is the first time I'm getting a role of this size. And I would like it to be about the work as opposed to my sexuality, which, for right or wrong, that's what I was feeling. Now, today, people don't feel a need to come out and make a big statement. People mention it in an acceptance speech. Oh, yes. And my husband, Phil.
Yeah.
Thanks. I couldn't have done this without him. So, but at the time was very much a time of people being outed and you know, obviously, yes, I agree with Harvey Milk. It's the most political thing you could do is to come out. But, you know, he was talking about to family and friends, not necessarily coming out in a public forum and telling the world that you're gay. And I wasn't ready or emotionally mature enough to deal with it. Just dealing with suddenly everybody knowing who you are was a shock.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like you think about around that time was, you know, Ellen's Yep, I'm Gay on Time Magazine and things like that. But she was already quite famous. But for you, it was almost like you were becoming a star. And did you not want that to be part of your story of becoming a star?
I didn't feel like I was becoming a star. I just felt I wanted it to be about the performance and not my sexuality. And so I just decided to say, I'd rather not discuss that, which ultimately you might as well have said, oh yes, I like sleeping with men. So you might as well have just said it. And I wish I had been brave enough to just, you know, when Oprah said, gee, you're awfully good at those girly things. Thanks, Oprah. You know, what I should have said was, why is that? She said, and I should have said, well, I'd like to think it's because I'm a really good actor. But if you're asking me if I'm gay, the answer to that question is yes. But I didn't say that. I was very nervous, meaning just being talking to Oprah. And Robin was very protective of me and saw where that conversation was headed. And he sort of quickly detoured her in another direction. But I realized, you know, this was something I was going to have to deal with.
Were you afraid of taking that role and being like typecast and people forever saying, are you, are you not? Is he, honey? I don't know.
Girl, you changed just in the middle of that sentence. I don't know. I'm telling you. Don't make me come out there. What was that? I love all of a sudden.
Yeah. So?
What was the question?
You know, for some reason, it's in the original play and film, the use of the word fag as sort of a punchline. And there was a scene coming up, and I went to Mike and I said, listen, I'm a little uncomfortable with this for me personally, but this character using the word fag, Alexander the Great was a fag. And I said, can't we use something else? And he made, you know, there was a long discussion. And as I said, I always felt like I'm just lucky to be invited to the party. And, you know, he went on about it. And finally I said, well, listen, you know, as the only fag in the room, it makes me uncomfortable. And he said, I understand. He said, just do one as written, you know, the oldest trick in the book. And I said, because I, my need to please, I said, yeah, oh yes, of course. And that's what's in the movie.
Now there's an idiotic issue, gays in the military. I mean, those haircuts, those uniforms, who cares?
You shouldn't be talking about things you don't know about.
Val, don't patronize your mother. She's an amazingly intelligent woman. You know, I think homosexuality...
A lot more ice for you.
Lots more ice, Dad.
One of the things that's weakening this country.
Really? You know, that's what I thought until I found out Alexander the Great was a fag. Talk about gays in the military.
And that's when you're saying it in character as the mother, right?
Yeah,
as sort of
right.
The conservative mother. Was that part of it for you, that it was coming out of her mouth?
Yes. Then why would she you know, is she pretending to be, you know, I said, to, you know, there's also the argument of, is he pretending to be a Republican just to win them over? Or, you know, but I don't think so. I think he's, you know, basically Elaine was saying he's on the same wavelength as Gene Hackman and Diane Weiss, which I also had issues with. But, you know, the great thing about the original French film was how subversive it was in that, you know, that even though it was in the guise of a French farce, you know, the heterosexuals were the villains and the gay people were the heroes, in particular, Albin, or in my case, Albert. But, you know, with the word fag, it's interesting. Two of the most sophisticated, groundbreaking comedians in the world, Mike Nichols and Elaine May, and yet they certainly came up in a world where that word fag was used as a punchline and wouldn't let go of it. You know, and I'll tell you, after the film had come out and was a big success, I was sitting in a cab in Midtown Manhattan in traffic, and there was a guy in a truck next to me, and he looked down, and I looked up, and he seemed to recognize me and smiled, and I sort of waved, and he started yelling, "Faggot! Hey, faggot!" And this went on and on and on, and you know, I sort of sunk back in the cab, and finally traffic moved, and I, you know, wanted to say I wish Mike was here so we could hear this use of the word. Not to get anything away from the success of the film and what it means to people and how it still makes people happy. But now, of course, when they show it on network television, they bleep that word.
Yeah. Well, I would say anything that's 25 years old, any piece of art is not going to have aged perfectly in every way.
Well, no. I mean, look, yeah, you can chalk it up to him. The character may be trying to ingratiate himself with them and saying it that cavalierly. But yeah, no, it was a weird moment in what was an otherwise perfect situation. A great thing to be a part of.
Do you feel like coming out affected your career in a negative way after you did finally say, you know, I'm going to go? I think it was the cover of Advocate or an interview in Advocate. Do you feel like that hurt your ability to play sort of any role that you might have wanted to play?
Well, not in the theater. Look, I don't know. We'll never know what is said behind closed door. I've heard things. I don't want to sound like Trump.
Yeah.
I've heard some things.
People are saying...
But I'm sure that it did. I'm sure it did. I mean, also my career was about the theater. If I really, really wanted the kind of film and television career that, you know, people seem to think that's what happens. The theater is just a stepping stone to film and television. And I always felt the place to really learn how to be an actor is in the theater. And as Terrence McNally taught me, it is a goal unto itself. It is a very important and maybe the most satisfying way of expressing ourselves in terms of acting. I admire film actors, and I love when I get to do it. So between my own need to work in the theater as much as I have, whatever it is, 45 years, and yes, perhaps, you know, look, after The Birdcage, I was offered two roles. I thought for sure, well, you know, maybe some really good things might come from this. And then I was offered a film of Mr. Magoo, and I can't remember the director's name. He was an Asian director, and the discussion was, I said, so you're going to do the Jim Backus cartoon character? And he said, yeah, but it's all new. It's all new, Mr. Magoo. So I said, well, will he have a shaved head and squinty eyes, and he's nearsighted, he can't see? No, we're not doing any of that. I said, well, what if you take that away?
What is there?
That's Mr. Magoo.
Yeah.
Well, hi, George. You know, if you're not doing that stuff, what is it? I don't know what it is. So, and it was a lot of money. I mean, a lot of money that I turned down, a lot of money. And then the other job was Mouse Hunt, you know, the new studio, DreamWorks, with Steven Spielberg, David Geffen. And that was a bit of a risk too, because I remember reading it and saying, well, this is like a Tom and Jerry cartoon come alive. And this director, and it was his first film, Gore Verbinski. And up to then, he was best known for directing the Budweiser Frogs commercial. But I talked to him, and he was, you know, really smart and a lovely guy. And he had a very dark take on this material. And he kept referencing, you know, Roman Polanski's The Tenant. And I would say, yes, that was good. But we're doing a movie called Mouse Hunt. And yet, so he turned this, you know, what it was, a children's or family film, into this subversive Coen Brothers movie for kids. And, you know, he got one of the most brilliant comedians in the world, a friend, Lee Evans, to play, you know, we play brothers. And I begged them. they weren't going to hire Chris Walken because he was too expensive. And I said, give him some of my money. I begged them, and they finally hired Chris Walken. So that was, you know, and that was a fun experience. But that was it. I didn't, you know, there weren't, it wasn't like there were a whole bunch of offers. Not even offers to play other flamboyant gay men.
Did you audition for sort of big comedy movies after that you didn't get?
I honestly don't remember. A lot of stuff coming my way. You know, I was with an agent at the time, who a man named Jeff Hunter, a sort of famous agent, had a lot of famous clients, Kevin Klein, Morgan Freeman. And I had a lunch with him where I said, gee, I thought more might come my way after The Birdcage. And he said, well, maybe if you weren't so open about your sexuality, it would. So he apparently thought I was pretty open about my sexuality.
Meanwhile, you're saying, but I didn't tell anyone.
You know, initially, you know, at that time, I did make a joke to some magazine where they asked if I was gay. And I said, I'm 40, single, and I work a lot of the musical theater. You do the math. What do you need, flashcards? I thought that it answered the question, but unfortunately, it didn't.
Apparently, not enough.
Not enough. Not enough. So, so yeah, that's what he said to me. And I was like, maybe it's time for a new agent. Look, you know what? I've had a wonderful, enviable career. Yes, I don't know how much homophobia has played a part in film or even television. I would think not so much in television, but
I'm curious if you have an opinion, just because this has become kind of in the last few years, I would say, a discussion about straight actors playing gay roles, and if you think there's a problem with that, or you think sort of anyone should be able to play anything.
It's a much bigger issue. And, you know, you have to take into consideration the world we're living in right now. And on some level, you can't really fight it. And sometimes there's a point, and sometimes it seems ridiculous. No, I don't think gay roles have to be played by gay actors. Do I think maybe something special might come from it? Perhaps. I just saw Supernova with Stanley Tucci, a friend, and Colin Firth, and they give beautiful performances. So here's an example. Here's something. And it ties in with podcasts and gay actors and this whole subject. Now, a year ago, I knew nothing about podcasts. And then, you know, I did Marc Maron. You know, he's like the mothership of podcasts.
Absolutely.
And then suddenly podcasts came into my life. So the pandemic, suddenly we have a lot of time on our hands. I'm listening to podcasts, and there's a podcast called Beyond the Box Set, run by these two young British fellas, in which they propose sequels to movies that they love that didn't have sequels.
Oh.
And one of them was, the title of the podcast was Birdcage 2, Starina Rides Again. So I got nothing to do. I listened to it. And one guy pitches, and then the other guy gives a pitch. The first pitch was not good. Then the second guy, his name is John Lucas, he starts to pitch another sequel. And I'm listening to this thing, and I'm thinking, gee, this is really good. He's suggesting actors who should be in it. And I'm like, wow, I'd like to see this movie. I had always thought, you know, Mike is gone, Robin is gone. You can't really revisit this. But what this guy came up with, I thought, wow, it's a way to honor Robin and go off on another adventure with my character and Agador and going to Guatemala. It's a really smart, clever, funny pitch. So I said to my manager, listen to this.
How about this?
He takes it to MGM. MGM likes it.
Wow. Wow.
So they're optioning it.
Oh, my God.
And they're going to try to see, if, you know, to team with a streamer, and it can actually happen. This is all because of a podcast, but...
That's so funny.
But finally, I said, maybe someone should mention this to Hank Azaria. He said, I can't possibly play the part. He said, people would go crazy. He said, I have one word for you, Apu.
Yeah, he's had his own separate controversy. Yeah.
You know, he said, I loved playing it. I would love to do it again, but it's just not appropriate now. And you should get a Latin actor. So then again, I thought, oh, well, that's maybe the end of that. And then I thought, gee, this idea is so good. If you could find a great Latin actor, comedian, it could still work. It's now 25 years later. We're all looking. Agador looks a little different.
Yeah, or maybe it's Agador's son.
Son of Agador.
Yeah.
Birdcage 2, Son of Agador.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Anyway, look, I don't know if it'll ever happen, but it's interesting. It came about from a podcast. And, you know, and I was saying, really, don't you think Hank would get a special dispensation from Guatemala, the government, you know, because he's so beloved in that character. And then yet, I've seen him referenced in articles about this subject, like, you know, that horrible stereotype.
Yeah, I mean, he's so fantastic in the movie, but I do understand, given everything that he's had to deal with, that why he wouldn't want to do it. But
and then my take sometimes is, you know what, just say, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do? You going to arrest me for playing a part? You know, I don't know. It can be carried to an extreme. I certainly get it. You know, it's happening now with this film, the Sia film, Music.
About autism or...
About, you know, why didn't they hire an autistic actor to play the autistic?
Yeah, I mean, these are conversations that just weren't happening when The Birdcage was made, really.
You know, you feel like, well, you know, if they made an effort to do it, and, you know, but I mean, to say it has to be this, or it has to be, you know, I think, you know, to a certain degree, it's like, well, you know, does this mean Meryl Streep is out of business because she can't do another accent ever again? She's not Polish. I don't know where, you know, the parameters are. And at a certain point, I understand it and I understand trying, making an effort to do it. But also, what about acting? Acting is, this is a part of acting, to take on different personalities, different, a totally different character than you. You know, Peter Sellers, he wouldn't be able to work today. So I don't know. It's obviously, I think it's a healthy discussion. So, you know, but I think it can be taken to an extreme. I get nostalgic for just being able to act.
Well, you know, I think obviously the other anniversary that I wanted to touch on, because I think it was sort of your next big thing after The Birdcage. It's now, I believe, the 20th anniversary this year of The Producers on Broadway, right?
Is it? Okay. Sure. I don't know. It was 2001. We did it.
We don't have a ton of time, but I just wanted to know if I could get a quick Mel Brooks story from you. Maybe the first time you met him or just something that stands out of your time spent with Mel Brooks.
Well, Mel is just a legend. And again, another, you know, hero and someone. It was such a privilege to get to work with him and collaborate. You know, I had met Mel, Neil Simon played Laughter on the 23rd Floor. The first time I met him, he and Anne Bancroft had come to see it backstage. They came backstage. They were very gracious. There was a character based on Mel in the play. You know, I remember him referencing it, saying that that guy who's supposed to be me, he said, it's a tissue of lie. but the next time I saw him, well, I was in Paris at the Ritz. I went down to the swimming pool and there were two people in the pool, and it was Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft. And so I said, hello. I got in the pool. Anne swam some laps. She went upstairs and Mel stayed in the pool and talked to me. And that's when he said, I'm writing a musical version of the Producers, and I think you're the person to play Max Gallistar.
Good thing you were at that hotel.
and so I said, well, that would be unbelievable. That would be a great, great honor. And at the time he said, I see you and Marty Short. And I said, well, that would be fantastic. And then Marty had just done a revival of Little Me and had spent a lot of time in New York away from his family and didn't want to make that kind of commitment again. And so happily, someone suggested Matthew Broderick, who was just perfect. And
yeah, it worked out well for him.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah. for all of us. It was just one of the high points of my career.
Speaking of Martin Short, who I talked to a few months ago when he was talking about this new project that they was doing with Steve Martin, and then I found out that you're in it as well. So I really can't wait to see this thing. Are you filming it now, or is it over? Have you finished? Or
no, I have no. But it's really smart and funny. And
it's Only Murders in the Building is the title.
Yes,
I believe.
It's called Only Murders in the Building. And it's about a podcast.
Oh, yeah.
A true crime.
It's kind of a true crime.
Podcast. That's a part of the plot. But Steve, who co-created it, Marty, and Selena Gomez. And
that should be a lot of fun.
It is. It's great fun just to be on set with Marty and Steve. That's just joyous. And I think it's going to be something special.
So I will let you go in just a minute. But we end the podcast by sort of talking about comedians who have made you laugh the hardest in your life. And what I'd love to know from you is someone from your childhood, someone who is sort of a contemporary of yours, and then maybe someone who's coming up below you who you've noticed. You can do any of or all three comedians who really make you laugh.
From my childhood, you know, I always have to cite Jackie Gleason. He was my idol.
An influence too, maybe.
Oh, without question. Without question. And then sort of ancillary, Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, but Gleason and Carney, but mainly Gleason. Also, Jonathan Winters really made me laugh. You know, him on The Tonight Show talking about his childhood. And, you know, he was that kind of, you know, genius. And Don Rickles, who I got to know a bit later in life, was God, he made me
laugh. So funny.
And then, a contemporary of mine, well, Robin, of course, for sure. He would make me laugh till I cried. In fact, it seemed to be a goal. I just have to say, please stop. You know, Marty Short, filming just only a few weeks ago. He and I, it was a long day. We were filming a dinner scene, and he was in a velvet suit with a ponytail. It was a flashback to when we were younger. And at a certain point, we both got a laughing jag going that couldn't stop. And Steve Martin as well. I mean, my God, another genius. And what was the third category?
If there's anyone who you kind of have seen, maybe who, you know, of a younger generation who really, who you think is someone people should check out, who you've liked watching, or just as someone who's been inspiring to you in some way.
Well, Mike Birbiglia, you know, I'm just a huge fan. And, Mitch Hedberg, how I loved Mitch Hedberg so much. What a tragedy that he's gone.
I know. He was a brilliant, brilliant man.
You know, I if you gave me a list, I could pick out.
Yeah. Those are all great people.
They're not, you know, they're not as so young, but yeah, I'm trying to think of young. Who's that? Julio Torres.
Oh, yes. He's wonderful.
I enjoy him. That's a unique point of view. And he's somebody very special and brave, and just, you got to love Julio Torres.
Totally unique.
But yeah, you know, there's many.
Well, this has been such a pleasure for me to get to talk to you. I'm just a huge fan. And as I said, this movie, The Birdcage, I think is just one of the all-time funniest films ever. So
thank you.
I loved talking with you about it. And yeah, good luck with everything that you have coming up. I'm excited to see what you have coming next as well.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it. Take care, old.
Say hi to Mike Birbiglia for me.
I will.
All right.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Nathan Lane for being our 100th guest on The Last Laugh. I am seriously looking forward to seeing him in Only Murders in the Building, opposite Steve Martin and Martin Short, on Hulu later this year. Oh, and if you still somehow haven't seen The Birdcage, it's available to rent or buy on pretty much all of the major platforms. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.